We get a picture of a scarecrow with scars and tatters. The poem is titled Scarecrow Love, and it's the next to last poem in this brand new collection. And how can we not, on some level, connect this scarecrow with one of the most famous scarecrows in all of the stories we know, the scarecrow in The Wizard of Oz, if only because the poet's second book, the one just before this new one, is titled Oz at Night, with a title poem in which we discover Dorothy, Toto, a tornado, and the ruby slippers. Often, The Wizard of Oz is described as a coming-of-age story, and in a certain sense, we may just travel along with poet Amanda Bradley as we encounter her poems in this just-released collection, especially with its autobiographical beginning, and in the books leading up to this one. She tells us her first book includes some of her youthful pieces and tends to reflect the struggles from her 20s. By the time we meet the Scarecrow, there's been a certain, using words from Oz at Night, a certain growing older, a hard-won wisdom from listening to the way the world is speaking more openly and frequently and clearly, and from going head-to-head with the obstacles and blocks preventing us from responding to the call to live our fullest lives. Asking what it might mean to answer that call, how to address all that interferes, what helps us hear, and what in the end matters. There's a wonderful sense of the comic in Amanda Bradley's writing, and by the time we arrive at the cornfield with the scarecrow, there is a full-bodied laughter of someone who fully recognizes in the vitality and depth of her vision the reality of tragedy, the dark, jagged, pain-filled aspects of human existence, in William Wedby's words, and the power and possibility of authentic love. And placed as it is as the penultimate poem, Scarecrow Love prepares us for the final poem to 21st century American women, a charge in a way to a younger generation rooted in a call to matter. Amanda Bradley's new collection is titled Queen Kong, and it was just released this past Monday by New York Quarterly Books. Amanda Bradley will be reading from the work this Saturday evening at the Old Brick Theater in Scranton as part of the spring edition of the Writers' Showcase. Amanda Bradley is an assistant professor of English at Keystone College in La Plume, and she paid a visit to the WVIA studios to talk with us about her work.
Hints and Allegations was my first book, and that came out in 2009. Some of those poems I had written in high school, to be perfectly honest. But I set poetry writing aside, sort of, for a long time because I went to a PhD program at Washington University in St. Louis. During that time, I had a friend who just resigned his position as Oklahoma Poet Laureate. And he was also in, you know, studying literature, but we would get together and swap poems. And so I kept writing poetry while I was in this literature theory-heavy program. But I didn't really try to publish or anything until 2004. And I was at a conference to read some poetry. And that's where I met the editor of NYQ Books. And, you know, everything took off from there. So that was a life-changing experience. So Hints and Allegations has a lot of my earlier poems from way back. And then some of the more, you know, the ones I was writing in 2003, 2004. And then I went to the New School for 2 years. And my master's thesis is pretty much my second book, Oz at Night, which came out just 2 years after Hints and Allegations in 2011. So it took me 6 years to get this next book out, Queen Kong. And I think that's partially just because I've been very busy, but partially because I wasn't sure what direction I wanted to go. Hints and Allegations is about sort of struggles of my 20s. And then Oz at Night is more philosophical and comical. And then Queen Kong, I really wanted to get the importance of feminism to me out in this book. And so the original idea was to write a whole collection of poems responding to quotations by women I admire. But then I had a moment 2 winters ago where I was working on a prose memoir. And I thought I could write a memoir in verse. And so I wrote that. And then I was discussing with the editor of NYQ Books, which should I pursue for this third collection? And he suggested that one informs the other. And the more I thought about it, I read it that way, read them together, and I thought that it hung together very well. So the long autobiographical poem, you know, sort of shows a girl growing up in America in the 20th century. And then the last third of the book, actually, the feminist poems, sort of show what happened after the fact of growing up in America as a female.
And language is so important. It is not just something to play with. Language has a real power to make a difference.
Absolutely. I think language makes a huge, powerful, important, you know, it's so important. It's so crucial to how we think, how we control situations, control people. It's very important. And, you know, I wanted to pay homage to these women that I admired so much who had taught me that and taught me that through reading their books. Audre Lorde is one of the women I have a quotation from as an epigraph of one of the poems. And she has this wonderful piece where she suggests that poetry is not a luxury, that it's a matter of life and death. And, you know, I think all the women I quote in here understand that. And by reading them, I feel like it helped me understand the power of language.
You just said the power of life and death, and I think our listeners would probably know the story of Anne Sexton and Sylvia Plath and their suicides. Your dialogue with her, for example, it isn't always that this language can save us.
Right, unfortunately, yes. When I think that Sylvia Plath and Anne Sexton were in a moment, lived in a time where pressure to be a certain kind of woman made it very difficult to be that kind of woman and a powerful poet. And I've read Sylvia Plath has said that there were no literary foremothers, you know, or not many. And that was a struggle for her. You know, who should she look back to know how to handle herself as a writer, as a poet, as a female poet? And then, you know, of course, her relationship with Ted Hughes was very fraught. But she and Sexton, when I was in graduate school, I had a 17th century class, a Restoration literature class. It was like Dryden and Marvell and Milton and these kinds of 17th century authors. And I went to the professor and said that I wanted to write about Aphra Behn, the only female we studied that semester. And he said he was so tired of reading essays about her. And I thought at the time I was sort of appalled, but then I thought, well, I bet that all the female graduate students are coming through this program and saying, yay, a female writer that I can write an essay about, instead of about Dryden or Marvell or Milton or Shakespeare, or, you know, all of these people that we were studying in the English tradition and the American tradition too for a while were male.
What about the anger and the rage we read in the vocabulary that you use to express this eruption? It seems like it's generational and seismic. It's not solely mm-hmm. personal. It's just this welling up of repressed anger.
Right. I mean, third wave feminism is going on now, right? So we have intersectional feminism happening. And I'm very excited about that. And I'm very excited by the young females I see in my college classes today. They are very... It's one way or the other. There are either those who say, I am not a feminist. And I remember being that way myself. You know, I remember entering college and saying, I am not a feminist. You know, I don't need to be a feminist. I grew up thinking I could do anything I wanted. You know, I didn't feel disempowered. You know, once you get sort of out of the bubble of school, and some students realize it sooner than others, but once you get out of the bubble of school, and encounter a workplace environment and unequal pay. I mean, but this sort of feminist rage was starting to well up in me earlier when I became a teen, I guess, because I felt sexualized before I understood what was going on, really. And I felt put upon and looked at in certain ways. And I looked around. I have a poem in here about the difficulty of being a Christian which I'm not anymore, but as a woman, because so many of the church figures and the figures of the religion itself are male. And, you know, things like that started to crowd in on me in college, and just feeling like everything in a position of power around me was male. And so it started to erupt in me really about halfway through college. But I see the same process happening today with college students, especially women. But, you know, now today you see more males identifying as feminists, which is fantastic. It's really great. And so I'm happy to see what's happening among college students. But there's still, you know, we're still in the Trump era. And putting together how that happened is going to plague us for a really long time.
We read this last week, didn't we, that the American Academy of Poets has just said that the number of hits on the website has quadrupled over last year, that people are now seeking poetry. People just seem to need poetry.
Yeah, I do think that people are turning to poetry, and I think of the artist as standing outside society, looking in, and sort of saying, here's what I can see from the height of this cliff, looking down on what society is, or not down on, that sounds bad, but, you know, outside of, so removed from. And right now it seems like we're having to inch closer in to carry the protest signs and that sort of thing, but still, you know, keep enough distance that you can identify what people can't see from within society themselves. And I think that a lot of people are so appalled by the autocratic rising of power across the world right now. And it's really terrifying. And we need poetry to put it down or put it in its place or bring democracy back to the fore.
We always talk about the creative spirits, the artists, being in advance of trends. Could you have anticipated the timeliness of this volume now?
I was hoping that it would be, you know, a celebration when I wrote it. And I knew that had Clinton become president, she would have faced a lot of obstacles as the first female president. I went to a Clinton rally in Scranton, and there were so many young girls there with their mothers and fathers. And I just kept looking around and thinking, you know, this was before the election, and I was thinking how exciting it was for these young girls to be looking to someone who, you know, to really feel one day maybe I can be president in a way that young females really can't today. So, you know, the last poem in the book tries to rally young people today around the cause of feminism. And its epigraph is from 1701, Lady Mary Chudleigh. And she wrote that, you know, we are kept down and then derided for it, for not being witty enough, for only being fit for drudgery, that kind of thing. So I use that as the epigraph and then try to say, you know, this is what's good about being born in the United States as a woman. This is what's bad about being born in the United States as a woman. And now it's up to you, young people, to figure out where we need to go with this. And fortunately, I do see a lot of young female students taking up the torch. It's very exciting.
Do you want to read for us?
Absolutely. Okay, so the epigraph for this poem is from Aline Sixou. She's a French feminist, and it's from The Laugh of the Medusa, translated by Keith and Paula Cohen. And she writes, "Where is the ebullient, infinite woman who hasn't been ashamed of her strength? Who, surprised and horrified by the fantastic tumult of her drives, hasn't accused herself of being a monster?" And it's called Queen Kong. "I've been shimmying up skyscrapers all my life, swatting at airplanes that buzz my massive head. I've been holding tiny men in my palm, careful not to squish life from their fragile bodies. I've spent my rage on the bars of this cage. Ripped from my native habitat, I can barely remember I am not a monster. My drives are ancient and furious. I peer into the tiny windows of your offices and see you skitter about in monkey suits. You think you are making the world go round, mastering complex transactions, but the world is simpler than that. It is the stench of my breath roaring at you through fangs clenched in a wide diabolical smile, showering shattered glass at your feet."
It's like a fist. Did this come to you in a I've got it. Was it that kind
pretty
of a
much,
piece?
Yes. And some poems do come to me that way, you know, and I think come to a lot of people that way. Like, it feels like inspiration. And there's that long history of the inspiration, the poet channeling inspired a speech or something, or thoughts or ideas. But yes, the idea of inspired writing, this was one of those moments for me, that poem, where it just sort of fell out of me. It did require some revision, of course, tinkering. And then other poems, of course, I really plod through to get where I want them.
There was no question in your mind that it would be the title poem, or was it?
No. It was someone else's idea, actually. I was thinking, you know, how do I want to handle, because I was focusing on how to put all the pieces of the book together, because there's the three sections. And then someone said, I think it was a friend who said, why not just call it Queen Kong, you know? And I thought, that's it. And that was just, you know, sold.
When you have a class full of bright young people, what kinds of things are you hoping to make possible for them?
Well, I mean, you know, there's the basic level at which I want them to understand the material we're reading. But there's also that I want them, I think in one of these poems, that I want them to understand the possibilities. Sometimes I'll say, like, when we're studying the Harlem Renaissance, for example, we'll be reading essays by Langston Hughes and Zora Neale Hurston. And I'll say, you know, these people just got together in a room like we are right now and had conversations with one another about how they were going to make a difference and what they were going to do. And each individual wrote in their own particular way, but they did. You know, they inspired each other, and you can do that too. That's what I want them to understand, you know, that they can make a difference in the world. And I think that we're so inundated with flimsy values through television and movies and through a lot of different venues. And it makes me very nervous for these young people when they need to be able to have time to sit down and absorb a novel, absorb a poem, and, you know, not just skim it, really get it and soak up the sort of values that make them human, you know, like what it is to be human, to feel it and experience it instead of having this sort of flashy, superficial, consumer-based world. There was a moment in pedagogy where they were calling students customers. They were calling students customers. And I thought, oh, that's just such a shame. That's not what school's about.
And it must be so rewarding to see a light bulb go off, even if a student doesn't say anything, but the eyes get wide and suddenly it makes sense.
When they understand or when they're moved, you know, something, anything like that, it's, yeah, you're exactly right. You can see it in their faces. And I tell them at the beginning of the semester, you know, I can see you too, because sometimes, sometimes I don't think they realize that, or it's just, they don't think about it. And I'm telling them, you know, like, I can see if you're on your phones, I can see what you're doing. But in that other way, you know, it's seeing the flash in the eyes, especially from the students who don't talk as much, who are quiet, but you can see that they're really interested.
Pick one more.
Okay. Escapist. I used to imagine I would travel. I wanted to write for National Geographic. This was before suitcases had wheels. Now I want to move everywhere I visit, to live on a small rock in the St. Lawrence River at Thousand Islands, to take my morning coffee and newspaper with other locals in this smoky cafe in Ketchikan, to watch the sunset in a cable-knit sweater from the shore of Galway Bay, to pass Buffalo through long straight shots of desert on my way home from work. You see, I want to live there every day. I want to live everywhere every day. Now we know how much there is here, how small we are, dragging our suitcases behind us.
Through literature, in a certain way, we do travel, don't we?
And oh, absolutely.
And we learn how big and enormous it all is, and yet how, I mean, isn't that part of what you're telling us?
Absolutely. It takes you places that you couldn't go. It takes you places, it lets you embody people you can't be, but it also helps you recognize what's so universal about all of us, how we all feel this, you know, we all feel love, we all want to be honest and struggle, you know, and all the struggles that we have, the universal ones. And there are some that we don't all have, of course. And that's where literature helps us reach out and see those, you know, or feel those in a way we couldn't. Like last semester I taught Salvage the Bones by Jesmyne Ward. And that is about an African-American family after Hurricane Katrina, you know, in the Deep South on the Gulf Shore. And the students, none of whom are from that situation, all really identified with the main character, Esh. They were feeling her pain and her successes. And I think that's so important.
Poet Amanda Bradley, assistant professor of English at Keystone College in La Plume, speaking with us about her new collection of poems titled Queen Kong, just issued by New York Quarterly Books, and reading from that work. Amanda Bradley will read from her collection as part of the spring edition of the Writers' Showcase at the Old Brick Theater, 126 West Market Street in Scranton, this Saturday, April 29th at 7 in the evening. Amanda Bradley will join Barbara Taylor, Alman Orrick, Heather Harlan, and Robert Filman for that program. That's the spring edition of the Writers' Showcase at the Old Brick Theater in Scranton this Saturday evening at 7. And we heard poet Amanda Bradley speaking about her just-released book titled Queen Kong, issued by New York Quarterly Books this past Monday. For more information on the web, amandajbradley.com. amandajbradley.com. The collection is titled Queen Kong, just issued by New York Quarterly Books. For more information on the web, amandajbradley.com. You can also check the website of the publisher, nyq.org.